From the Paley Center for Media in New York, this is Max Media. Here's Max Robbins.
Hello, everybody. This is Max Media. I'm Max Robbins. This is the show that covers the media industry, how it runs, and why the people that run it do what they do. And today I'm here with Brooke Gladstone.
And I don't run anything.
We don't run anything but our mouths.
Exactly.
Brooke is the co-host and managing editor of WNYC's On the Media. And her show is about, I think it's been called, How the Media Sausage is Made.
I wrote that.
You did write that.
But you know, Max, you've managed to be even more meta than me, which I didn't think was possible because I report on people who report on the media. And with this show, you are reporting on somebody who reports on the people who report on reporting the media.
Well, this goes back to my bad childhood and getting a haircut every 2 weeks and sitting in the barber's chair between two mirrors and seeing these infinite images. And I've kind of taken that experience and how traumatic it is and tried to turn it into a career.
There's just only so much fluff one can pick from one's navel, don't you think?
No, that's limitless, really. Anyway, Brooke's show on the media, which she co-hosts with Bob Garfield, is really a singular in how well it does what it does in covering the media universe in a really expansive way. And I think that that's part of the key to the success of the show. I'm really curious because the show has evolved. Give us a little brief history how this all came to be.
Well, the show actually began as a local call-in show on WNYC in 1995. They decided to take it national a few years later with Alex Jones, who wrote that great book about the New York Times, is now at the Shorenstein Center as the host. It didn't seem to work out. Brian Lehrer, WNYC's excellent morning talk host, came in and actually did the hosting for On the Media for a couple of years, but he had to parachute in when he wasn't producing 10 hours of live radio, and the show was very underfunded, and ultimately they were thinking of it was circling the drain and they were going to pull the plug, and then they decided maybe we can get NPR to pony up a little bit more money because they've just raised our dues being the hugest station in the system, and maybe they feel guilty about it. I don't think that would apply at all anymore, but back then in about 2000 it did, and so they decided to relaunch it, and I was NPR's media reporter, so they picked me to come in and relaunch it with a few extra people and a new focus, whatever focus I wanted.
But it really was a roll of the dice for you at that point. I mean, you'd been covering media, I think, at that point for, what, 5-6 years?
Oh, personally?
Yeah.
Everybody said I was crazy.
You are, and, you know, all things considered, the powerhouse show. You've got a really primetime beat, if you will.
Yeah, people cared about it, and I got to be Scott Simon's fill-in's host, and that was cool. But I just, and I know this is going to sound a little odd, but I was just so horribly bored with covering the media that I wanted to be put on general assignment, and they wouldn't do it. And so
you were so bored with it that you decided to do a show that was about nothing else but covering the
media.
I
decided that if I was going to be stuck with the media for the rest of my life, that I wanted to cover it the way that I wanted to, which isn't and define it the way I wanted to, which is different from how NPR defined it and covered it. And I wanted to bring a new set of rules to the coverage of the media, which hadn't been done in public radio and in most mainstream media before. And so I thought, if I'm going to have to do it, then I'll do it my way and I'll try a little experimentation.
Did they really give you that kind of a blank check, if you will?
I mean,
not economically, of course.
Definitely not economically. But they definitely, you know, what Dean Capello said, and he was the head of programming and still is at WNYC, was, look, you know, this show almost died. We've decided to resurrect it for the third time. Well, it was born, then it was resurrected, then it was resurrected again. You know, it's not a national show. The national program wasn't successful. It had about 60 stations, 250,000 listeners. Not terrible, but it wasn't going anywhere. It was starting to shed stations. It wasn't anybody's fault. It was a really good staff, but they were inexperienced. They'd never produced a national show, and Brian couldn't put his full attention into it. With more resources, they probably could have done it with that staff. But in any case, he said, just make it a national show. I had been the editor of two national programs before I was a reporter for a few years each. Scott Simon's program, and I was the senior editor of All Things Considered for 3 years in the late 80s and the early 90s. So before I became a correspondent. So he just said, you do it.
Wow.
And we can't afford an editor, so
you do that too. Wear a couple of hats. And how did it – one of the things I think that makes the show work is the chemistry and different perspective you have with your co-host, Bob Garfield. How did that happen? How did – was Bob selected by you or for you? Is this an arranged marriage?
It was kind of an arranged marriage. Bob and I had been really good friends since I was working on All Things Considered,
and
since
he'd been writing about advertising for forever and a day for advertising.
That's right. His day job was as he would humbly express it, as the world's most powerful advertising critic. But his his sidelight was doing these kind of bizarro Charles Kuralt in America pieces for All Things Considered, and he was there before I was at All Things Considered, and I edited him, and we became friends, and we stayed friends over time. And then when Dean wanted me to come and do the show, I told him, and I felt that I didn't think I could do what he wanted by myself. I didn't think it would sound as good, and it wouldn't be as interesting, and it would be too limited to my perspective. And he brought up, or it may have been someone else on the staff, but at the time, but Bob had co-hosted on the media on a couple of guest hosted for Brian. So had I. And, you know, we'd never even talked about it. And then they suggested Bob, and that really clinched it for me. That made me want to go do it.
If you kind of delineated how this professional marriage works, if you will.
It's like bratty siblings. I am the snotty older sister who gets to tell the younger brother what to do. Although I'd like to say, for the record, since thanks to Bob, sometimes this is misunderstood, I'm 3 months older than Bob. That's all. But in any case, but I do have, you know, because
I know radio is a theater of the mind, but, and I don't mind saying this publicly, he looks a lot older.
Yeah, don't say that. but in any case, you know, we fight quite a lot. We do. And we have long arguments. In fact, almost everything that is on the program is the result of a long debate, and not just me and Bob debating, but every producer on the staff knows how to hone an argument, pitch an argument, sell an argument. It has to go through an idea. It has to go through a lot of hurdles to get through the on the media extruder, because I don't care about the media. So the big thing is to make me care.
Come on, you really don't care?
Not much.
Do you not care about the media in terms of that kind of Upper West Side of New York, Park Slope definition of the media?
I will concede that part of it is a reaction to so much self-absorption within our ranks. I certainly wouldn't say that I'm not self-absorbed, but I'm more self-absorbed about personal.
You mean
things.
A little media narcissism? I know you once said you were talking about being on the media beat and getting bored with it at NPR, that you were tired of having to cover every time Tina Brown farted. I think was the
quote. I know that was. I shouldn't have. Fred thought, my husband thought that was really unnecessarily vulgar. But yeah, I did say that. And I just felt that I wanted to talk to people who did not live within the specified area codes, who are guaranteed to care about these things, or zip codes. I wanted to. I wanted to make clear all the time, every time, on every story, what the stakes are for a regular person, a civilian. I didn't want to do a story. I didn't want to do a show for specialists.
This is Max Media. I'm here today with Brooke Gladstone, the co-host of a wonderful show on NPR, On the Media. And we're in meta Mediaville today,
sure
I guess.
Are.
I mean, with that,
I can only imagine the person who actually listens to this program.
Well, I'm going to ask you about the person who listens to your program, because you made a point that you – it seems that you do feel a certain sense of responsibility to the, quote, public, your listeners, when you're making editorial decisions, when you're the pieces that interest Brooke Gladstone. How are you imagining your audience?
Well, here is where I think maybe a little bit of narcissism may come in handy. I think of myself as the average listener, because Sorry, there's no cough button. Because I'm not that engaged, sort of, intrinsically or reflexively, I have to sell the stories to myself. I have to understand why they're important to me, why they matter to me. What are the stakes? And I do think that the media is an incredibly important beat. I just think that everything depends on it. It reflects who we are. It informs who we are. It guarantees that the best parts of ourselves remain.
Just this doesn't as sound it, to me like somebody 2 minutes ago told me they didn't care about the media.
It's I don't care about it so much as a business, except so far insofar as the business impinges on what I believe is a genuine and important mission.
And if you were to describe that mission?
The media, now how I see the mission and how people who relate to the media see the mission are often different things, that they're interrelated. They're inextricably intertwined, really. I really do believe that we know ourselves by looking into the media mirror. But I think that a lot of people misunderstand the role of the media to be a reflection of their individual concerns all the time. And I think that this sense that the media are out there and they're telling us how to think and how we feel just isn't true. I think there is a symbiosis, and you can't tell which is the driver, the actual news consumer or the news producer. I really think it's a chicken and egg thing, and they work in tandem. I mean, there's so many times that the media have lagged behind the public, so many times they've tracked with the public. But very rarely, never actually, I would say, have the media as a body, because they're so diverse, have ever gotten together to tell the public how to think. And yet every time I go into public, there's a sense of conspiracy theory abroad. And people believe that somehow we're organized enough to talk to each other and that we aren't actually at each other's throats all the time.
Well, certainly. I mean, there have been times, too, that the organization that you've been a proud member of for so long, NPR and at WNYC, there's that sometimes that attitude in other sectors of the media that, you know, this is, you breathe a certain rarefied air, and that it's, and are detached from.
Yeah, well, you know, which it depends what you mean by rarefied. They don't have to answer to advertisers. On the other hand, not WNYC, but NPR has rightly been accused of being, you know, a bunch of weenies when it comes to going outside a very narrow range of political opinion. I mean, especially post 9/11, whenever the country feels threatened, any media, not just public radio, feel constrained to stay within a particular zone, not because they're afraid of their funders or the government per se, but because they're afraid of their viewers, their readers, their listeners. They're afraid of their audience.
Push things too far to alienate them.
That's right. And that will be expressed in the commercial world by losing advertisers.
In your world, though, you still are aware of, I mean, you've built a huge audience. I mean,
yeah, middling audience. Under a million. So, you know, until we get totally, I mean, we got the last book, I think, was like 920 or 940, and then we have another 40 or 50 on podcasts. So we're just under a million. But
wow.
that's you know,
40 or 50,000 people are downloading podcasts
On a weekly basis. Yeah, roughly that. They won't count that in our numbers, sadly, because they don't know how many of those people are actually listening, and they don't know how many of those people overlap with those who fill out the diaries. So, you know, it doesn't count, but it counts to me.
It should count to you. I mean, because I'm a loyal podcast listener, and I think that means that seems like a really important number, because that's an engaged listener who's actually made the effort to subscribe.
And it's like the size of our New York audience, practically. So it's huge. But yeah, they don't count it yet. They don't know how to reckon with those numbers. They're a little behind.
you were talking about that fear of pushing buttons. In the course of what you've done in On the Media, there have been times, and maybe in recent times, where you felt you pushed the wrong button, or that you were...
Every single week, you know, people are pissed off at us. I mean, we have a comments section after every story. And, you know, there's always somebody calling us, you know, corporate tools or, you know, go back to Russia, you know, one or the other. And it's...
No middle ground?
No, I mean, there's middle ground there, too. But, I mean, the thing is that here is where our show differs from any other national public radio show, in that this is a program ostensibly of analysis and commentary for an hour. NPR has no other program of analysis and commentary. We don't break news. We bring little reported stories to people so people will find news in the program every week. But we are very rarely investigative. I think we got one award for investigative journalism for something Bob did. And
what
we were very proud
about,
of it.
Just so we...
It had to do with these video news releases that Alexander Haig was involved with, that public television stations were running without acknowledging that these things were being paid for by funders of the station. And they were pitching things. And it was just – it was kind of infomercially and unseemly for public television to be doing that. But that was like 5-6 years ago. But mostly we don't break news.
Do you think – and it is –
To make my point, and very, very quickly, because we do a news and analysis program, and so much of it is spent passing judgment on or picking apart the performance of colleagues, we felt the need to be absolutely open and straightforward when we had a point of view. In other words, we owned our opinions. We didn't do this sort of repertorial locution of, oh, what do you say to the people who say that you blah, 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 blah? If we feel that there's a criticism there that we share, we say it. We put the criticism in someone else's mouth when we don't share it. Therefore, we are out there. We are hanging out in a way that makes that is very different from how National Public Radio does business. But it was a conscious decision to disclose, given that we were spending so much time mucking about in the sandbox with our colleagues, telling them what we think they should be doing. People ought to know what our biases are.
Well, we're very biased. We're big fans of On the Media, the show, our guest, Brooke Gladstone, co-host. This is Max Media. And as I said before, we're talking with Brooke. With that in mind, is there a time where you think you can be too opinionated? It seems, I mean, this is just as a loyal listener over many years, and
come on, spit it out.
I will say this: I think it seems that your co-host Bob Garfield is more comfortable with doing really pointed opinion and commentary than you are.
That is true. That is one point of.
In fact,
contrast.
I noticed the weeks you're on vacation, I can expect a really piece of
political invective.
Yes.
Well, you know, my feeling is that our biases, the time that we devote to them on the program and express them, should be limited to media-related issues. We have a First Amendment bias. We have an access to information bias. I mean, if people saw us weighing, you know, issues, you know, well, is this, does it weigh on
the
side?
You guys really are First Amendment absolutists.
Pretty much, not 100%. I know Bob has been really mean to publishers who publish books like, you know, How to Build Your Own Bomb and stuff like that. I mean, there was a big hang-up on our show with Bob just saying, you know, how do you sleep at night and things like that. So it isn't 100%, but it's a very strong bias in most instances in favor of disclosure and access to information and against secrecy. And so we were critical of Obama's decision to not release the photos, although I had sort of mixed feelings about
the photos,
the torture
out of,
photos,
yes,
that the ACLU had gotten, you know, a court order to get. And we were, and both of us were incredibly critical of the Obama administration's invocation of the States Secrets Act, which closes down legal proceedings because they pose a threat to national security, just closes them down. And it was used heavily. It was a sort of little-known late 40s statute that was passed and was not used all that much until the Bush administration. Obama decried its use and abuse on the campaign trail, and now he's used it 3 times in his first 100 days. And that's just frankly depressing. So, you know, so people will say you're Obama lovers, and we mostly are hugely relieved. It's a very different environment from the Bush administration in terms of information, but there are places where there are serious lapses and concerns, and we express them. In terms of other things that are political but are not tied to the media, I really like to veer away from those. And it's also my style to present my position and present the other person's position. And having disclosed, leave it up to the listener. Bob can occasionally be a bit of an advocate. I think there's a role for that on the program. Some of some of the times when we differ with each other on the program is around over issues like that.
That kind of advocacy. However, I think you do both share a sense, the sense of responsibility. We talked a little bit earlier about that kind of watchdog that you guys are. And I think that you are doing in-depth journalism. While you say you don't break a lot of news, but you do a lot of in-depth analysis, pieces that run 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 minutes sometimes.
Or the 15-minute Star Trek piece that ran last week.
Yeah, I think that showed a certain bias.
We definitely do analysis. We do a lot of analysis, a lot of pieces on a lot of issues. Bob did a great piece on Brand America. It was about hearts and minds and exploring the American brand during the Bush administration. How is it working?
Well, you followed up on that recently, too, about do you call it global warming or
right.
do you call
it? We really take apart the political lexicon, the current words of the day. We call it Word Watch all the time. We think that is a great anecdotal way to look at how debates are being framed within the media. But in terms of the watchdog role, I think a lot of people misunderstand the show and they think that every time a news organization screws up, we should be there explaining exactly how they did it. And again, this is where I feel like the listener surrogate, they're really not going to care how, the St. Louis Post-Dispatch dropped their coverage. And by the way, this is not true. I'm just totally making this up. It's a made-up anecdote. But, a random paper dropped its coverage of the local auto company because the auto company took ads. It happens all the time. It happens everywhere. I just don't know how interesting that is to do
ultimately
it every single time.
Right. However, where you are doing this kind of this looking at the media and trying to do it with substance and mostly succeeding – that do you that was a little
that's all right. No, that's okay. 70-80%.
I'd give you a better grade. But I do think it's interesting that you're doing it in the context of public radio. And what I'm wondering, and I know you've covered this quite a bit and watched this regularly on the show, do you think in terms of substantive investigative journalism, substantive analysis, thoughtful journalism, is it going to become purely the domain of public-supported media?
I wonder whether – it is true that there have been a lot of experiments with the nonprofit business model. We see it in ProPublica, which is partnering. It's a group that's funded by a patron, mm-hmm. With great investigative reporters, many of whom are refugees from the Los Angeles Times and the New York Times and elsewhere, who will do work and then will partner with papers to get it out in front of the public. And they are supported by, the Sandlers, right? They're very wealthy people. And that's a way to do it. However, there are you talking just about investigative reporting, or are you talking about worthy reporting, or local reporting, or foreign reporting? Because there's
I think it's all of the above. I think that there seems to be a real push on, a real pressure right now on quality and comprehensive journalism of every variety.
There is a website called Seattle West that came to be after the Seattle Post-Intelligencer just went online. They started picking up a lot of ads, and they have, basically it's run by two reporters who hire freelance reporters to cover the local board meeting on urban renewal or whatever the local issues there happen to be, and they are managing to survive.
You're cautiously optimistic that we'll come up with a viable financial model? So
I think that I'm cautiously optimistic that we will come up with an infinite number of financial models that if we want it, we will find a way to supply it because, that's the way capitalism works, and even in and it's just the way human beings have worked throughout time. I mean, the history of journalism is long. The history of the way we currently do it is not as long, but it still has lessons to teach us that there isn't just one mode, and that there isn't just one set of principles that you can apply to quality journalism.
You're listening to Max Media. My guest today is Brooke Gladstone, the host of On the Media.
Very humble, Max Media. Did somebody force that name on you?
Busted as usual. You know, the worm does kind of turn today. Brooke has interviewed me countless times over the last 10 or 15 years, and I was really, in one sense, I was really looking forward on this to this.
Not anymore.
That quickly passed. In part of your journey in covering the media and kind of putting a spotlight on all sorts of different areas of it, I understand you are writing a book.
Yes, I am writing a graphic nonfiction treatise about the American news media called, well, not just entirely news media, also entertainment media, but mostly news media, called, tentatively, The Influencing Machine. Which is ironic, which means I have to come up with a subtitle that explains that I don't mean it, that this is what people think it is, but it isn't.
It isn't.
And
is
so there, it's more of a reflection. It's a mirror. And that's my theory.
It's a graphic novel.
It is, yeah. It'll be mostly in panels.
Is there a heroine in this?
I do appear in Avatar.
A fictional character named Brooke Gladstone?
A non-fictional character named Brooke Gladstone, but I perform no heroic acts. Because, as I said, it's a non-fiction and I have performed no heroic acts in life. But it's going to be illustrated by this brilliant illustrator named Josh Neufeld, who has a book coming out about Katrina, a nonfiction book called AD, After the Deluge. And he's also done a lot of work for Harvey Picar and others. So he's definitely in that world, and he's just great. And Norton just bought it, so now I know that will actually get done.
Congratulations.
Thanks.
When are we going to be able to download this book to our Kindles?
Yeah, no, it'll be very interesting to see. I mean, as I said on the show recently, it's going to be not very long. My guess is within 6 months that we will be able to download books with a color capability. Not that our book is just going to have, I think, a single spot color used elsewhere. But the, we are designing it right now for most online graphic books, whether memoir or adventure stories or nonfiction of any kind, they usually happen panel by panel. It's a different format for viewing than seeing it in a sort of classic comic book. So it'll be interesting to see how this book translates to the electronic book world.
It will indeed. It will indeed. before we let you go.
Aww.
I know. You can come back anytime.
Thanks, Max.
The velvet rope, never up for you.
I didn't tell you when. I think I don't know. Just to answer your question, but I think it'd probably be something like fall of 2010.
Okay, I think it'll make a great gift, great stocking stuffer for Christmas.
Or if we can get it out earlier, maybe we can get people to buy it in their journalism classes, assuming anybody else still wants to become a journalist in 2010.
So it sounds like you continue to be really engaged in...
In the thing that I keep saying I'm not interested in?
Yeah, very interesting.
There's a problem there, isn't there? A little inconsistency. Yes, I am. I think it's because how can you not be? Everybody and their maiden aunt is incredibly engaged in this right now because we are seeing this technological, revolution, and it's expressing itself first and forever in the media, and it is dragging every single human being who owns a cell phone into it. I mean, there's that old saying, the people who own the printing press, are the ones who control who have the power of the press. Now, whether you want to or not, if you have a cell phone and it can take a picture and you can go online with it, you have a printing press.
I think that's a great place to close. This is Max Media. Our guest today has been Brooke Gladstone, co-host of On the Media, and we couldn't be more pleased.
Thanks, Max.
That you came by.
You've been listening to Max Media, a production of the Paley Center for Media in New York City. We're on the web at paleycenter.org. That's P-A-L-E-Y center.org. And you can reach us by email at maxmedia@paleycenter.org.